This segment of the Financial Sense News Hour is brought to you by Nationwide Financial. For more information about Nationwide's products and services, please visit nationwide.com. That's nationwide.com. Neither Nationwide nor any of its affiliates is related to or affiliated with Jim Poplava of Poplava Securities, Incorporated.
This is the Financial Sense News Hour with the president of PFS Group, Jim Poplava. Since 1982, PFS Group has offered asset management and educational resources that have helped investors build, maintain, and preserve their wealth. And now our lifetime income experts, Jim Poplava and Kathleen Harris.
Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava, and welcome to this week's edition of Lifetime Income. Coming up on the program today, we're going to talk about how to prepare and protect a surviving spouse, and we'll tell you why this is a very important aspect in retirement planning. We'll get into the statistics, the whys, the wherefores, and the things you need to do.
And later on in the program, Jim will be talking with Dr. Judith Fradkin from the National Institutes of Health about type 2 diabetes risk and prevention, something that's kind of near and dear to my heart. Jim, let's talk about why we're covering this issue of preparing and protecting your spouse after you pass away. Let's talk a little bit about why we chose to do a little bit on this topic again this week.
Well, first of all, we got a lot of input, especially last week, about protecting a spouse. But, Kathleen, if you look at statistically, you know, we all remember the words, anybody that's married at the altar, till death do us part. And the sad fact is, when you take a look at this, the final passing of one spouse, if we take a look at statistically, according to the Scientific American, women on average outlive men by 5 to 6 years. And I just know from our own practice, being in this business for over 3 decades now, you know, when I take a look at surviving spouses, I would say almost 80% of the surviving spouses are women. And even when you take a look at the situation of even single households today because of divorce, so we're seeing surviving spouses is a more prominent aspect of retirement planning just simply because of longevity.
Right. And I think the reason why this is such a big issue to talk about, Jim, is that, and we see this in our practice as well, for the most part, for most families, the husband is the one who's primarily responsible for the family's overall financial picture and the one who does the primary interaction with all the financial advisors and the estate attorneys and the accountants. So the problem comes up, what happens when you take away that key point person in the family from the picture, and all of a sudden there's no one left who interacts with the advisor, the accountant, or the estate attorney? All of a sudden the surviving spouse is left and has no idea what to do next.
And you mentioned something, Kathleen, and we also see this in our practice, and I'm sure a lot of our listeners that are tuning into this program are in a situation where they may be married, and that's exactly it. The husband is making the financial decisions. Either he is managing the investments himself, or he's the point man between their portfolio and, let's say, whatever advisor or series of advisors that they may be working on. And oftentimes, the wife is kept in the background. It's kind of like, okay, that's something my husband does. He takes care of that stuff. Well, remove the husband from the picture, and what happens to a surviving spouse? We're going to talk about a couple case studies here. But maybe the next area we ought to tackle, Kathleen, is talk about the strategies, because we're calling this how to prepare and protect a surviving spouse. So let's talk about the preparation aspect and talk about, because you deal a lot in the area of documents, paperwork, and a lot of those things. Take it from a strategy in terms of what are the things a husband and wife should be concentrating and focusing on to prepare.
Well, Jim, I would say the first thing is, as a couple, your basic preparation for one of you passing away is to have both of you know where all of the important documents are, whether it's electronic or it's an actual physical binder or folder, for example. Make sure that both of you know where things like all of your account statements are located, where contact information for all your key point people, your accountant, your investment advisor, your estate attorney, that you know where that contact information is located, that you know where all your trust and estate documents are located. Maybe even you'll keep a copy of your latest tax return, information on any financial plans that you have going on, especially if you have an income plan, particularly if it outlines income scenarios after one of you passes away, that both of you know exactly where all that information is located in your home and you have easy access to it in case one of you passes away. There's not this mad scramble in the middle of your grieving process to try to find all these documents and know where the money is and who's in charge of managing it and what banks or institutions are involved. Just even having all the paperwork in one place is just a huge, huge saver of time and stress for the surviving spouse.
And Kathleen, you talk about something, and I'll just relate this in our own case with the San Diego fires in 2007 when we had to evacuate our home. We have all our documents in sort of like one of those folders. It's like a plastic crate that has, you know, the estate plan, key documents, life insurance policies, those kind of things, because, you know, when you're facing the possibility that your house could burn down, and think of all the tragedies that we've seen over the last probably decade, as recently as Hurricane Sandy last September, of the number of homes that were destroyed and people were left homeless. So it's not just the fact that you may end up being the surviving spouse, but think of where you live, that you may be subject to weather-related events, you have to evacuate your home for whatever reason. Having those documents located in a centrally planned place, and let's even take a worst-case scenario. Let's say that both spouses, let's say they get in a car accident. What about the kids? They have to come in, and they find out, you know, we don't even know what mom and dad have. And so there's a number of reasons, not only just for a surviving spouse, but for your children, your successor trustees, weather-related emergencies. And I thought maybe what we might do to bring this home is, Kathleen, share with our listeners a situation where we did have a surviving spouse that we had set up a living trust in, some of the issues that were going on that took place that created quite a problem. And I'm going to add a new one after you discuss this.
Sure. Well, Jim, I remember when I first started working for you, one of my very first situations where I dealt with a surviving spouse who happened to be a widow was a situation with, we had a couple longtime clients of ours. Husband passed away. Family was actually very well to do. The clients had quite a few assets with us, as well as a good insurance policy. After the husband passed away, the wife came into our offices and she was just beside herself. She was so concerned about the fact that she was going to go broke. She had no idea what sources of money she had. She had no idea what their overall financial picture looked like. She didn't know what the insurance was going to cover. She was just completely unprepared for the situation. And it was really stressful for her because she was concerned about, am I even going to be able to buy my groceries and fill my car with gas? She was that unprepared to become the responsible person for the finances in the family. The other thing that happened with her, which was very unfortunate, is because she wasn't really prepared to understand how her estate plan had been set up with her husband. At the time of his passing, their trust split into two pieces, which we've talked about a few times on the show, an A trust for the surviving spouse and a B trust for that essentially is for the rest of the heirs and beneficiaries. Well, because she didn't really understand the difference between the A trust and the B trust, she kept spending assets from the B trust on things that weren't really permitted by the terms of the B trust, ended up in a situation where she ended up owing the B trust about $130,000, mostly from having paid off the mortgage from the house that was in the A trust. So again, I think it's just really a good idea for you as a couple to kind of have a basic understanding of what's our financial condition, what's the plan after one of us passes away, just so you both kind of have a general understanding about what's going on and where you're at.
And there's another problem that emerged in this particular case, Kathleen, and that is she was on the internet and exchanging emails. Somebody hacked into her email, got a hold of her bank account information, and within about a week or so after this happened, we assumed that it happened right away, we got a call from somebody that came across as her son and was asking for us to transfer money to a bank account that we had in Florida. Now, luckily, it was a situation where our team got on the phone, talked to this individual, asked him key questions. What was your dad's name? You know, just a bunch of personal questions that only we would know, that this individual that hacked whoever these criminals were that hacked into her account, we knew enough questions to ask that they couldn't answer. And then what we were able to do is alert the client. You know, there are a number of issues that come out like this, and there's just all kinds of problems that emerge with a surviving spouse. She didn't know how to handle this, and we told her through our technical team things that she needed to have installed on her computer to protect herself. But here was a case of a surviving spouse, had plenty of assets, was well taken care of with the not only Social Security, pensions coming in, and the assets coming in, but got involved in commingling assets. I want to talk about something else here, too, and that is emotional preparation. And that is something, I mean, you know, if you're thinking on a weekend, it's a Friday night or a weekend, the last thing you probably want to do is sit around the table and say, hey, let's talk about me passing away. But getting your spouse prepared, either one for that matter, of what takes place, what are the events, the sequence of things that have to be taken care of. Let's talk about the emotional preparation, because it's one oftentimes that happens by surprise, especially if, let's say, a spouse is lost due to a heart attack, a stroke, or something like that that occurs suddenly, or even something as tragic as an accident.
Right. And we've had several of these happen over the past several years, Jim, where we've lost clients that were in their early 60s or mid 50s unexpectedly from accidents or heart attacks. And the surviving spouse was just completely unprepared, not only financially from the financial education standpoint, but also just sheerly emotionally prepared for this thing to happen to them. So I think the first step as a couple is, you know, really you have to think about this as an act of love for each other, is to really help each other feel emotionally prepared to understand what's going to happen if one of you passes away. So you approach it from that standpoint. And I think it's important for each of you to share with the other, first of all, what are your main concerns about what might happen to you if and when I pass away? And you sort of talk about those emotional concerns first. And a lot of those concerns have to do with family matters, but most of them have to do with money. So some of the things you talk about are things like, who do we contact if one of us passes away? What kind of funeral arrangements do we want? What's our estate plan look like? How might our income and insurance situation change if one of us passes away? What's our overall financial condition? If only one of us is left, will we still have enough assets to make it through to the end of our lifespan? And something else to think about, too, is how might our living situation change if one of us passes away? Maybe you downsize, maybe you move in with a family member, maybe you move into some kind of community. But I think just having the ability to look down the road and be able to imagine the life after, even though it's a little scary, helps the spouse in the moment when it actually happens to feel more emotionally prepared and able to deal with the decisions that have to be made when someone passes away.
And the other issue I'd probably throw in here, Kathleen, is sometimes you have a spouse and, you know, you've run across this because you do a lot of the paperwork and things like that, where you have a spouse, especially a lot of the women, and ladies, I'm not picking on you, but, you know, you may have other things that you would rather do than manage the investments, deal with the financial advisors. And we do have couples where the spouse just says, I can think of one particular client that they get into an argument every time the husband tries to engage the wife. And let's talk about a case study of why that is not the best way. And for women listening, if this isn't of something of interest, let me tell you why you want to be involved. Imagine if your estate plan isn't in order and all of a sudden your assets are frozen and you don't have access to them and have to go through a court. Imagine a situation where all of a sudden, you know, most of your, let's say, sources of income actually come from your investment portfolio. And let's say it's sizable. all of a sudden now, you know, we get into a situation like we did in 2008 or 2007. We're in the midst of a financial crisis, or even worse, you're in a situation where you've got kids that are now pulling on you. We see this so much today with spousal abuse, either from children, or you have a situation where, you know, the wife is grieving and she had a good relationship with her husband. It was a long-enduring relationship. Usually, if you've had a good marriage, chances are, if you're still young enough, you're going to get remarried. What happens if you commingle assets together with different children? Talk about creating a nightmare scenario in an estate plan when you pass on. Or just having to deal with, you know, filing tax returns, 706 returns. And let's talk about a case study that kind of exemplifies that and what a husband is doing to make sure that this is not going to be the issue if he passes on.
Well, this is actually a great story, Jim. We had a lot of response to our little piece we did last week about the surviving spouse. And one client in particular called me and just said, Kathleen, you and Jim could have been talking about me and my wife. I've tried for years to get her involved. I even tried to get her to listen to this segment. But every time I try to talk to her about it, she just walks away. She has absolutely no interest in the finances of our family. So he decided, rather than trying to force her to become involved, his solution was, okay, I'm going to just accept the fact that this is not how it's going to work for my family. So number one, I've got all this physical metal I've got stored at my house. What's the reality that my wife is going to be able to A, locate it, and B, ship it to some bullion facility to get it transferred into cash? So he's shipping his physical metal to us for storage. The second thing that he's doing is he's got accounts scattered all over in different brokerage houses. He's consolidating all those assets into one brokerage house, which is us. So the spouse only has to deal with one firm when she's dealing with the assets upon his passing. And the third thing he's doing is he's accepting the reality that she has no interest in handling the finances and tax preparation. So what he's doing is changing his trust situation so that instead of his wife becoming the successor trustee, a corporate trustee will become successor trustee, thus removing the burden of all this decision-making from the shoulders of his spouse. So again, sometimes you can want to sit down with your spouse and share this information with them, but sometimes they're just frankly not going to be interested. So if they're not going to be interested, you know, maybe you don't force it. Maybe do what this client is doing and do your best to streamline and simplify and extract your spouse as much as possible from the decision-making.
And in this case, as the case we discussed last week, where the husband set up an account just before he died, and the wife got remarried, where her second husband tried to get at the assets and get her to commingle. Thank goodness we were there to stop that. But in the final tragedy, the son got involved and got involved with the broker and took a balanced portfolio of cash, bullion, laddered bonds, dividend-paying stocks, and put it into a back-loaded mutual fund with one broker. And it sounded great. It was a great story to the son, and it was sold. And so it's not just the fact that a surviving spouse may have to confront dealing with investment issues that they're not prepared or knowledgeable enough to deal with. You have children that can come into the picture and abuse. And then you also have unscrupulous advisors that may want to come in and sell a one product fits all perfect investment to either the surviving spouse or the children who may not be knowledgeable. And this is one way with a corporate trustee. And you know, it was amazing, Kathleen, when I first got involved in this business, I actually taught estate planning to attorneys because I had taken several graduate level tax courses on advanced estate planning. And we were doing trust. This was back in the early 80s when trust weren't as ubiquitous on the West Coast as they are today. And I had sort of come to the conclusion, make it easy, get the assets in the trust, you avoid probate, get an AB trust or a spousal flex trust, you save on estate taxes, you save on probate, you save on all the grief of incapacity, all those kind of things that make a trust great. And we made it easy. You know, you name junior or both brother and sister as, let's say, successor trustees in case one spouse passes away or you become incapacitated. But for whatever reason, over the last 15 years, we have seen numerous cases of what we call elder abuse, spousal abuse, and it's becoming more frequent where either children get involved, in-laws get involved, son-in-laws, daughter-in-laws get involved over money. They're scrapping and they're pulling on the heartstrings, or in some cases, unscrupulous advisors coming in selling an easy solution. And it's one thing that we've changed in our practice where, as you know, Kathleen, we insist on when we take on a client, we have an estate plan so that we know that the issues of incapacity, estate taxes, probate are taken care of. And one of the things that we're starting now, and especially with our wealthier clients, is we are putting on special one-on-one seminars where we're going to bring in corporate trustees and estate tax attorneys to talk about the multiple options that are available to save not only the assets for the heirs, to protect the spouse, and to carry on the family legacy beyond one generation, so that at least clients are exposed to that, because I think this is important. I think the very issue you mentioned of the client of not really dealing with these issues. And let's face it, a lot of times, I mean, whether it's doing a budget, whether it's having to do with the vagaries of the market today, more volatility, more complexity, government intervention, the change in the tax laws. I mean, if we just take a look at where we were January 1st, 2013, with the fiscal cliff, we didn't know what the income tax rates were going to be. We didn't know what the estate tax exemption was going to be. We didn't know what gift taxes were going to be. Estate taxes, all of those things were up for grabs. That, I mean, this is just one example of how complex this has become. And imagine if all of a sudden you have an estate plan that was based, we'll call it Model A estate plan, and now we're driving automatic cars, faster engines. You know, the laws change, and you have to design that flexibility. You want to make sure you're up to date. It's not like, okay, we did our estate plan 2 decades ago, and we haven't changed it since. Asset markets have changed. Your net worth can change. The tax laws can change. The investment environment can change. And heck, just looking at family dynamics, death, birth, grandchildren, divorces, all the family dynamics that you can think of that come into play here, which is just another reason why you have to have a plan. And if you can't engage your spouse, and if there are husbands listening to this program, do yourself a favor. Say, promise me that you'll have your wife at least listen to the program. She doesn't have to make any decisions. She doesn't have to do anything, but at least listen to the fact that she's more likely in about 80% of most marriages to be the survivor. And as survivor, these are things that she is going to have to deal with, whether she likes it or not. And that is, I think, one reason, Kathleen, that, we got, so I couldn't believe the response that we got last weekend. And the thing was, okay, I get the message. I understand you. That's just exactly where I am. But what are the things that we can do in advance? And so, Kathleen, why don't you sum it up for us?
Some of the very basic things that you can do to sort of get through this whole preparation of your spouse for something happening to you is, number one, get everything consolidated into one place. All of your documentation, all of your information, make sure it's all easily locatable in one easy to find place. Number two, go ahead and sit down and have that difficult conversation about what it's going to be like after one of you passes away. What are the things that need to be dealt with? Just take yourselves there emotionally so you can visualize it and move beyond the grief to what happens afterward. And number three, if you find yourself in a situation where your spouse just isn't going to be involved, has no interest at all, accept it and find other strategies to deal with things so that your spouse is left with the minimum burden to bear, and she's able to focus more on other things at the time of your passing, like grieving for you, for example. So those are just a few of the strategies that you can use to prepare your spouse for something happening to you. So coming up in the program next is Dr. Judith Fradkin. She's the director of the Division of Diabetes, Endocrinology, and Metabolic Diseases at the National Institute of Diabetes and Digestive and Kidney Diseases. Whew, that's quite some title. She and Jim are going to be talking about the type 2 diabetes risk and prevention. This is actually quite a personal topic for me. My father was diagnosed with type 2 diabetes in 1991, and he passed away from this disease in 2008. And I have to say, having watched him go through this diagnosis and the whole process, that I know what Dr. Fradkin is going to say is actually completely true. A lot of my father's early passing at age 67 was due to the fact that he didn't take some of these preventative steps. She's going to be talking about prevention and things you can do if you are diagnosed and things you can do to prevent having diabetes. One of the things I just wanted to bring up, Jim, is, again, why are we talking about this on a, what's essentially a financial program? And the reality is that people who have diabetes, on average, have a medical cost of about $13,700 a year in medical costs, about $7,900 of which is just due to diabetes. And on average, people with diabetes have medical expenditures that are 2.3 times higher than everyone else. So there's a real financial reason to listen to this next segment. It's going to save your pocketbook, might even save your life.
And more important, Kathleen, as we've been talking about here, when we do retirement planning, you know, most people talk about their budget. We talk about their basic living expenses and kind of getting people to know that number. And then we get the bucket list. But also added in, which is not factored into most retirement plans, is long-term care, serious illnesses that crop up. And it's one of the reasons why we are tackling here on the program the three biggest killers of Americans today, which is heart disease, cancer, and diabetes. And the good news is heart disease, in many cases, even cancer. You know, heart disease and diabetes are definitely preventable. And you're going to want to listen to this interview with Dr. Fradkin, because there's a lot of good news here. There's steps that you can take to live a normal life, bring your costs down, prevent the disease, correct the disease if you have it or have been diagnosed with it, and what are the things that you can do? And we talk about this in this financial series because this is a major expense in retirement planning, and especially when you get into the latter years, and it's an expense that most couples don't plan for. They just think, oh, Medicare is going to take care of everything. And we have a program coming up on Medicare with an individual that's head of the government's Medicare program that will air not this week, but the following week, that deals with the issues of Medicare fraud and one of the issues the government has dealing with it. And later on, we'll be talking about what Medicare doesn't cover, a lot of the myths there. So the reason we bring this into this program is, understand, you're going to spend, husband and wife, on average, between the both of you, about 25 years of your adult life in retirement. And especially as you get into those last years, medical expenses is going to be the single largest expense in your budget. And many of you haven't planned for it. So maybe one of the best ways to plan for it is just keep yourself in good health. So that and more coming up next with my interview with Dr. Judith Fradkin from the National Institute of Diabetes, Digestive, and Kidney Diseases. Joining me on the program today is Dr. Judith Fradkin. She's director of the Division of Diabetes, Endocrinology, and Metabolic Disease in the National Institute of Diabetes, Digestive, and Kidney Disease at the National Institute of Health. Doctor, welcome to the program. We're going to be talking today about one of the big killers of Americans. We've had heart disease, cancer, and diabetes. In your opinion, what has caused the increase in diabetes in the country? Is it diet? Is it exercise? Is it the foods we eat? What is behind it?
What we're talking about in terms of the major form of diabetes, which is type 2 diabetes, which used to be called adult onset diabetes, the increasing rates of overweight and obesity and sedentary lifestyle are making a major contribution to the increased rates of diabetes. And that's why we now call it type 2 diabetes rather than adult onset diabetes, because we're even starting to see it develop in adolescents and young adults as obesity rates rise. In addition, the aging of the population has contributed to increased rates of diabetes. The fact that our population is more diverse, many racial and ethnic groups are at increased risk for diabetes, Hispanic Americans, African Americans, South Asians, so that as the American population has become more diverse, we have more diabetes. And then one piece of good news is that people with diabetes are living longer. We have good treatments for diabetes, and so people have a longer life expectancy.
Doctor, how can type 2 diabetes be prevented? I mean, I know there is, in some extent, isn't there a hereditary factor, but can that be overcome?
Yes. In fact, our major clinical trial that the NIH sponsored called the Diabetes Prevention Program included many people who had the major risk gene for type 2 diabetes, and we found that people with that risk gene responded as well as people who didn't have it. So this was a study in people who were overweight and had a condition called prediabetes where their blood sugar was higher than normal but not as high as is needed for a diagnosis of diabetes. And people in that group without any treatment, about 11% per year, would go on to develop type 2 diabetes. Our clinical trial showed that a lifestyle change, being more physically active, losing weight, didn't have to get down to the ideal body weight, losing about 15 pounds could make a huge difference. The people who lost an average of about 15 pounds reduced their rate of developing type 2 diabetes by 58% over 3 years. We also found that a drug that's used to treat diabetes, metformin, also could slow the development of type 2 diabetes, although its effect wasn't as large as the effect of lifestyle change.
Is there anything in terms of diet that a person can do? I mean, obviously, gaining weight is not good, and it makes you susceptible to the disease. But are there certain kind of foods that can trigger it, like high sugar, high fat type of diet versus, let's say, a lean protein, something like the paleo diet, a vegetarian diet?
I don't think we have any evidence as far as diabetes goes that it's really anything other than the amount of calories that you eat compared to the amount of calories that you burn. So we generally recommend that people try to stay away from calorie-dense foods. Now, recently there was an exciting clinical trial looking at the Mediterranean diet in terms of preventing cardiovascular disease, but I don't think we have results yet for any specific diet other than avoiding weight gain that would lower the risk of type 2 diabetes.
What's the difference, doctor, between, let's say, a type 2 adult onset diabetes and type 1? I remember when I was growing up, one of my friends in the neighborhood had type 1 diabetes because he used to take some kind of insulin shot. What's the difference between the two of them?
They're really two completely different diseases. They both manifest with high blood sugar, but type 2 diabetes starts as a person becomes resistant to the activity of insulin. So the fat tissue in a person's body makes a number of factors that makes insulin not work as well, and gradually the body tries to make more insulin to overcome that insulin resistance, but eventually the pancreas can fail, and then the person develops diabetes. And so that's why it's so important to do things to make insulin work better in your body, like trying to keep an ideal body weight and being more physically active, because your muscles are actually the place where insulin does most of the work. So being physically active really helps the insulin that you have work better. Type 1 diabetes, which used to be called juvenile onset diabetes because it mainly strikes children and young adults, is an autoimmune disease. So the body's immune system, the system that helps fight off infections, mistakenly attacks the cells in the body that produce insulin and destroys them. And so that disease is unrelated to obesity and can't yet be prevented by anything that we've discovered, although we have a lot of research ongoing to try to figure out ways to prevent type 1 diabetes. And interestingly, type 1 diabetes is also becoming more prevalent in the United States, and we don't know why that is. We think there must be some environmental factor that's increasing the rates of type 1, and we have some major studies ongoing to try to identify those factors so that we might, for example, develop a vaccine or something to try to prevent exposure to triggers to type 1 diabetes.
Doctor, if I'm told that I have type 2 diabetes, what should I do to treat it early, and what effect does, let's say, early treatment have on the disease?
In one study that we did where we looked at lifestyle change, weight loss, and more physical activity in people early in the course of type 2 diabetes, we found that a number of people actually reverted to normal glucose or to pre-diabetes if they lost weight. There's also a drug which is called metformin, which is an inexpensive generic drug, and it's generally agreed that that is the first line therapy for type 2 diabetes. That drug actually causes a little bit of weight loss, and it also helps the insulin that your own body is making work better in your body. It's a very safe drug. Millions of people have taken it, and that's generally the first therapy. We recommend that people with diabetes try to have good control of their blood sugar to try to prevent the long-term complications of diabetes. It's also very important for people with diabetes to control their blood pressure and their cholesterol, because most people with diabetes die of cardiovascular disease. The risk of cardiovascular disease is about double if you have diabetes. So it's really important to take statins and control blood pressure to prevent the risk of cardiovascular disease.
Is it possible, for example, let's say you're diagnosed with type 2 diabetes, you go out, you go to a gym, you lose 20 pounds, you change your diet, you go to a low-caloric type diet, lean protein, get rid of the fats and sugar, you lose 20 pounds and you exercise 6 days a week, could you get rid of the disease or is it with you forever?
People with type 1 can't get rid of the disease. Some people with type 2 can get rid of the disease for a while by losing weight. Some people with type 2 who are obese and who have bariatric surgery also can reverse type 2 diabetes. It often comes back later in life, but the better that you do in terms of controlling your weight and being physically active, the easier to control the diabetes will be, because the natural history of type 2 diabetes is that it progresses over time as your body loses the ability to make insulin. And so gradually you need more and more treatment to control the blood sugar. About half of people with type 2 diabetes will eventually need insulin, but you can slow down the progression of type 2 diabetes and the need for more medication to take to control the blood sugar. You can also reduce your need for medication for blood pressure and cholesterol as well by losing weight.
You mentioned heart disease, that many people with type 2 diabetes end up dying of some kind of cardiovascular disease. So you talked about controlling, let's say, blood pressure, cholesterol. What are the other main complications from diabetes? I've heard that there's problems with blindness, you can lose your sight. What are all the complications of the disease if it's not properly handled?
In addition to the heart disease, problems involve the eye and can lead to visual loss. In addition, kidney failure is largely due to either diabetes or high blood pressure or both. In the United States, people with diabetes lose sensation in their feet, and that can then put them at increased risk for amputation of the foot or the lower extremity. In addition, people with diabetes are more susceptible to infection, so it's important to get flu shots and pneumonia vaccinations. Erectile dysfunction is more common in people with diabetes. There are many complications associated with diabetes. Most of those complications can be slowed with good control of blood sugar, particularly the eye and the nerve and the kidney complications of diabetes can be reduced by as much as half with good control of blood pressure. And also with good control of blood sugar, and also blood pressure and cholesterol control are very important for reducing complications.
In terms of complications, are you more likely to get it as a result of age? Because, you know, there's been a number of studies done that Americans are becoming more obese. You can see it with children today. You can see it with young adults. Is the disease more likely to appear as you age, or does it affect all age groups?
It affects all age groups. The peak age of development of type 2 diabetes is actually in the 50s, but then because people continue living with diabetes as well as additional people develop diabetes as they get older, the overall rates of diabetes go up over time, and about a quarter of people over 65 have type 2 diabetes.
If somebody is, let's say, diagnosed with a disease in their 50s, can they live a normal lifespan if they take care of it quickly. In other words, they start making dramatic lifestyle changes. They exercise, they change their diet, they lose weight, they keep their blood pressure or their cholesterol low. Can they live a normal lifespan?
Absolutely. At every stage of the disease, you can do things that will improve your longevity. So early in the course of diabetes, taking good control of your blood glucose, as I say, can reduce the risk of complications by more than half. Even when people develop complications, they can control those complications. There are drugs, for example, to slow the rate of kidney disease development. There are treatments for visual loss with diabetes. So if you have diabetes, it's important both to control your sugar and your blood pressure and your cholesterol to prevent the complications, but it's also very important to be monitored for the development of the complications, because if you find out early that you have a complication like eye disease or kidney disease, there are treatments that can prevent you from going on to actually losing vision or developing kidney failure.
Now, what about those individuals? Because we've seen a lot of advancements in medicine. You know, I can think of my own family. My grandfather died of a heart attack, his fourth heart attack at age 63. My grandmother, who had heart disease because of some new drugs that came on the market, lived to age 78. So what can individuals do that have had diabetes for decades to preserve their health?
I think being physically active is one of the most important things that people can do to preserve their health. Trying to achieve a healthy body weight is important, but it's also very important to take medications that are effective in controlling blood glucose, blood pressure, and cholesterol. And it's important to remember when you take those medications that it's not like treating an infection where you can treat it and then stop taking the medication. You know, when you need medications to control sugar or blood pressure, those are medications that you have to take for life. You can't say, okay, now my sugar is controlled, I can go off the medication. So it's really a partnership with your healthcare provider. Most of what people do to take care of diabetes, they have to do themselves. And so it's really a long-term commitment to monitoring your own health and taking small steps to improve your health. Everything, you know, that you do in terms of increased activity, adherence to medications, those things make a huge difference. We have clinical trials that prove that you can reduce bad outcomes by half with some fairly simple measures.
Doctor, you work for the National Institute of Health. What research efforts are underway to prevent and treat diabetes currently?
We're about to start a major clinical trial to compare the various classes of drugs that are available to treat type 2 diabetes. As I mentioned, it's agreed that metformin is the first line drug, and that's the first drug that people with type 2 diabetes should take. But there are about a dozen different classes of medications, and there haven't been long-term head-to-head comparisons of those different medications. So we're going to do a study in about 5,000 people looking to see when metformin isn't enough to control your blood sugar. We're going to compare four different kinds of diabetes medications and look over time to see how they affect the progression of type 2 diabetes. And there really hasn't been a long-term comparative effectiveness study like that. We're also about to launch a trial looking at additional methods to prevent type 2 diabetes. In particular, we're going to look to see what effect vitamin D might have on preventing type 2 diabetes.
Doctor, as we close, are there any resources you'd suggest for people who want to learn more about diabetes or how to prevent or manage the disease?
Our National Diabetes Education Program, which is a joint effort between the NIH and CDC, is a great resource for people. Coming to our NIDDK website, we have a lot of health information for people with diabetes. We have information in English and in Spanish, and we have information at various levels of reading ability. We have some simple materials. We have samples of information about how to start a behavior change program. A lot of information is available at our website, and if you just Google diabetes and NIH, you'll get to that information.
Well, listen, Doctor, I want to thank you for joining us on our Lifetime Income series. Once again, we've been speaking with Dr. Judith Fradkin. She is Director of the Division of Diabetes at the National Institute of Health.
Thank you. It was a pleasure to talk to you.
Well, that concludes this week's Lifetime Income series. Once again, we'll be addressing these kind of issues, whether it's taxes, investments, or health, as you think about retirement planning. And the three issues that we're going to be concentrating on are the three big killers in this country: heart disease, cancer, and diabetes. Please check out Google Diabetes and the National Institute of Health. There's plenty of great information. The good news, as the doctor said here, is with proper diet and exercise, you can arrest the disease and live a normal lifestyle.
You can subscribe to Financial Sense NewsHour in the iTunes and BlackBerry podcast libraries or at feeds.feedburner.com/FSN. Find more information about our guests at www.financialsense.com/newshour. Friend us at www.facebook.com/financialsenseonline. For our on-the-go listeners, you can access Financial Sense on your mobile device at m.financialsense.com. The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of James Poplava and do not take into account listeners' suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense NewsHour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertising with Financial Sense, or arising out of the use of any material on the NewsHour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.
This segment of the Financial Sense News Hour is brought to you by Nationwide Financial. For more information about Nationwide's products and services, please visit nationwide.com. That's nationwide.com. Neither Nationwide nor any of its affiliates is related to or affiliated with Jim Poplava of Poplava Securities, Incorporated.